May it please the Court, Dale.
Your Honors, the Bankruptcy Court's application of the Barton case is simply wrong. It's not what Barton says. There's no authority in this district, in this circuit, saying this is how it's to be done here. It was not created over 100 years ago to give lawyers a free pass from malpractice claims against them, nor for them to breach any pre-existing fiduciary duties that they might owe their clients. In the Crown Vantage case, the Court held that Barton protected folks, certain folks, and that those folks can still be sued after the Court balances the interests of all the parties involved. And here there was no balancing of Blixeth's interests. His rights were simply swept away by a misapplication, in my view, of the Barton decision and an incomplete application of the Crown Vantage case. Here the Bankruptcy Court's decision constitutes a de facto adjudication of Blixeth's common law rights and violates his rights under 28 U.S.C. 157b5 to litigate his personal injury tort claims. We think, and we've advised the Court that in our view it's also contrary to the Stern versus Marshall case in Article 3. Here there wasn't any effort to pre-screen the case or separate pre- and post-petition malpractice from...
Basically, the judge found that, given the complaint, that they were wrapped together universally, as I understand it. In the sense that, I mean, no one's really doubting that if he had just sued about pre-petition malpractice, that would be one story. But in every instance, he then tied it into Mr. Brown's actions as part of his role in the bankruptcy.
Your Honor, it seems to me, though, that in the process of utilizing Barton for purposes of coming to a conclusion about how the case should be handled, that the Court threw the baby out with the bathwater. The Court on several occasions in several of its decisions, and I'm referring to the Bankruptcy Court, was able to point to activity that was definitely pre-bankruptcy and indicate that that could be the basis.
Which activity do you assert is just nothing but pre-petition?
Your Honor?
Not at all in any way connected to the bankruptcy.
As the Bankruptcy Court said in the record ER 578, quote, for instance, any claim Blixeth may have stemming from Brown's advice with respect to...
What allegations in the complaint do you contend are limited solely to pre-petition conduct?
Any advice given with respect to the marital settlement agreement, the releases, et cetera, provided there, getting Mr. Blixeth involved in the...
When you read the complaint, though, it all comes full circle to the what happens at the bankruptcy proceeding.
Well, and Your Honor, I think logically it did, because...
Well, then how can you limit it to just pre-petition?
Well, the acts giving rise to the torts, you know, it's just like I suppose if you run a red light until you're stopped and ticketed, is it an infraction? Do you know that there's an infraction until somebody brings it to your attention? In this case, there was really no harm, no foul until the bankruptcy was filed and Mr. Blixeth was looking down the barrel of a $40 million judgment for his involvement vis-a-vis the Credit Suisse loan. Now, the Credit Suisse loan took place back in 2005-06, and Mr. Blixeth was involved in that based upon advice which he was specifically given by Mr. Brown.
If there hadn't been a bankruptcy proceeding, would Mr. Blixeth have a cause of action for malpractice against Mr. Brown?
I think so.
On what basis?
Well, assuming there was no bankruptcy, but at some point somebody said, you can't use that money for these purposes. You've got to retain monies for the ongoing nature and business of the Yellowstone Club. then at that point in time, there may be, it may have brought, been brought to his attention that there might be a problem with the way he had been using the funds from the Credit Suisse loan. And that's an interesting facet, and I think that's something that, that Judge Kirshner specifically recognized in some of his earlier decisions. He said the cornerstone of this loan product was that it allowed preferred resort owners such as Blixeth to capitalize on the value of their asset. Now, if you were advised that that's fine, that that's acceptable, it's something you can do, it's permissible, and Blixeth did it, and nobody took issue with that, then probably we wouldn't be here. There wouldn't be a claim because there would be no harm, no foul, as it were. But the fact is that subsequently, Blixeth was advised, subsequently, various creditors took the position that that was not something that he could do, and he had been improperly advised that it was something he could do. So there's the negligence, the legal negligence, and it certainly predates petition.
And what about the dissolution?
Pardon me?
The dissolution?
Solution would be...
Dissolution. Divorce? There's a separate claim based on the advice.
Right. There were a number of allegations relative to the release.
When did the dissolution happen with regard with...
The divorce?
The divorce, yes.
That was in 05, 06 as well.
Also before the petition?
Yes, sir.
But it had an impact on the bankruptcy.
It did.
And with it, same question Judge Pius asked you about the advice on the loans. would the problem exist if not for the bankruptcy?
There may well have been issues cropping up as a result of all that, irrespective of the route that it did take, which was bankruptcy.
And what is the specific advice that he complains about?
Well, the various releases and so forth, and it ended up argument about improper allocations of assets and the tax nature of the allocation of assets and so forth. Now,
so when I looked at the complaint, the allegations relating to the LeMond litigation, that seemed to stand on its own.
I think it did.
Because LeMond filed suit to get his share of the distribution. And Mr. Brown represented, didn't Mr. Brown represent Blixeth in that litigation? And in the allegations in the complaint, if I remember correctly, it's that Blixeth alleges that Brown didn't advise him that he had that this should have been brought as a derivative claim.
I think that's
isn't that different?
Total of that.
Right, but isn't that so? The allegation is that it was malpractice not to advise him of the that particular defense. That little scenario seems different than the allegations that Judge Kaczynski was just alluding to.
I think because
they all seem to come together once the bankruptcy is underway.
I agree. I think they're all severable instances, severable acts of legal malpractice, not particularly at all related to each other. But
the question, the LeMond litigation issue seemed to be also not particularly connected to Mr. Brown's role in the UCC. But the rest of them, every time I'm sitting here reading the complaint and you tell a story and then you say, and you did this terrible thing by going and being the chair of the UCC and then suing him and basically turning on him. And that is the story that's all the way through the complaint. Maybe you could have separated out the pre-petition issues, but you didn't.
Well, Your Honor, I think in the submittal that was made with the filing of the amended complaint, mm-hmm. I think at
The third amended complaint.
Yeah, I think what he did on three pages was he presented a table outlining this is what our pre-petition complaint against Brown is all about, and here's how it might relate and intertwine with post-petition. And
that's in the motion for leave. Is that what it's in?
Yes, Your Honor.
Uh-huh.
That's at pages ER 595 through 597. And I think counsel who put that document together did a good job trying to differentiate and delineate what the pre-petition wrongful acts were and what the post-petition wrongful acts were.
And You've got about 4 minutes left. Do you want to save any of that for rebuttal? I'm sorry, I wasn't sure whether you were still answering Judge Bezos' question.
Thank you, Judge. I'll save 3 minutes. So I'll use up another minute, if I may.
Whatever's still left on the clock will be yours.
Thank you. Your Honor, the case, and I mentioned it previously, Crown Vantage, says that you have to look at the claims, whether the claims pertain to actions of the trustee while administering the estate. That is, the trustee's work on the estate becomes action which determines whether there can be a claim or whether there is a claim which can be brought. And we're not saying that anything, there are allegations of conflict of interest. And if you can see in the emails initiated by Andy Patton, that he had real concerns about the potential conflict and so forth. And Mr. Brown was justifying why there shouldn't be that concern. But in any event, beyond that, we're not alleging that there was a specific act done as a trustee or as somebody designated by the bankruptcy trustee's office. He wasn't appointed. He wasn't sitting on any committee specially designated by the court. And we're not alleging that there was any act in an official capacity that might provide Barton relief. There simply isn't any activity that should be protected under Barton. So I'll reserve the rest of my time. Thank you, Judge.
Thank you. May it please the Court, Counsel. They try to portray this as a simple legal malpractice case. And the issue before you is where the three judges who looked at this erred in applying the Barton Doctrine to the UCC.
Oh, that happens all the time. Those three judges.
It might happen all the time, except this.
So why don't you go on and talk about why they're right.
Why they're right?
Yeah.
Well, you guys have focused on the Credit Suisse loan.
I mean, you've got the Barton problem, and you've got a Stern problem. Right? So let's talk our way through it. First of all, does Barton apply at all to Brown?
Absolutely, Barton applies.
Says who? He's not a trustee, right?
Says Crown Advantage, says In re DeLorean, which Crown Advantage relied upon.
DeLorean was 10th Circuit?
DeLorean was a Sixth Circuit case.
They're upside down.
Did DeLorean actually address this?
Yes, DeLorean, if you look at footnote one of the members sued there was a UCC member, actually the chairman of the UCC.
Right, but first of all, I thought he backed out at some point, but it certainly didn't address the question, discuss the question, analyze the question.
There's not been a case which specifically says UCC is an other officer. However, Crown Advantage specifically says that Barton Doctrine applies to not only the trustees, but other officers appointed by the bankruptcy court. And as Judge Malloy indicated...
But not even the trustee is appointed by the bankruptcy court, right? It's appointed by the U.S. trustee, right?
The U.S. trustee.
So
the U.S. and the U.S.
The bankruptcy court approves, I know, because I've done this. You approve a trustee, and then somebody else appoints a trustee, as best I can remember from my days as a bankruptcy judge.
That's exactly right. Somebody else.
So why does this even apply to the trustee? But this is not the creditors committee is not appointed by the court. The chair of the creditors committee is not appointed by the court, right?
But the bankruptcy court approves every appointment, and it's essentially this.
Well, if the Barton Doctrine sweeps that far, then couldn't sue your lawyer. I mean, there's all sorts of people that you couldn't. I mean, the bankruptcy court approves lots of stuff.
The bankruptcy court does approve a lot of stuff, but in this particular case, it approved the appointment of the UCC members, including Mr. Brown.
So what? Does that make the UCC members officers of the court?
Yes, absolutely.
You say that, but why?
Crown Vantage says other officers of the court. And N. Ray DeLorean, Sixth Circuit case, specifically said it applied to UCC members.
Well, we're not bound to the Sixth Circuit, so assuming they considered that, and as Judge Berzon has pointed out, they didn't really say much about it, why don't you persuade me why they're not wrong, as they often are, on other issues?
Why don't I persuade you on what?
Well, persuade us why we should follow the Sixth Circuit.
Very well, because of the acts. When you look at the complaint that they presented to Judge Cursor in the bankruptcy court, were specifically about Mr. Brown's alleged conduct, which precipitated the bankruptcy court trustee pursuing action.
Suppose they rewrote the complaint.
What's that?
Suppose they were to rewrite the complaint and allege essentially that the advice, in other words, that the advice given caused these problems, and that regardless of Mr. Brown's role on the UCC, the UCC and the liquidating trust would have gone after Brown for these things and caused him all this grief.
He's already had his day in court.
I'm asking you hypothetically, would that be okay?
No.
Why not?
Because Judge Cursor has already addressed those issues. When you read what Judge Cursor wrote and in the documents we cited, when they argued about the Credit Suisse loan, Judge Cursor looked at what Steve Brown's role was on the Credit Suisse loan. And he concluded Steve Brown did not give Mr. Blixith advice. They had a hearing on it. They had depositions and discovery on it. He gave him no advice on the Credit Suisse loan.
And in the other case?
In this underlying case.
In the underlying case, not in this.
And they presented that. They had the opportunity to put on evidence.
Well, this is a separate lawsuit, though, not in this lawsuit.
No, in this underlying AP 14 proceeding.
Right. It's not underlying. I mean, it's not underlying this case.
It's part of this.
Okay.
AP 14. They put on evidence. Mr. Blixith put on evidence, and Judge Cursor looked at it and said, Steve Brown did not give advice to you, Mr. Blixith, on the Credit Suisse loan. Your allegations about that don't have any merit. Your only role on the Credit Suisse loan was to give advice to Credit Suisse.
But that would require – but that wasn't the ground on which the permission to proceed was given – was denied here.
The ground was that all of this was interrelated, that what they said Steve Brown did on Credit Suisse, the marriage settlement agreement, release language, even Lamont, was all intertwined with Steve.
What I'm asking you is whether this complaint – forgetting what the truth is on the ground.
Forgive me.
Shorn of the connection to Mr. Brown's role at the UCC, mm-hmm. would be covered by Barton.
I'm not sure I understand your question again, Your Honor.
All right, forget it.
Well,
I've asked it three times now, so
it's
not going to
help. If you asked it, and I believe I tried to answer it, every single allegation they made against Steve Brown was because of his
actions. I'm still waiting for you to answer Judge Kaczynski's question.
On why Barton Doctrine should apply
yes.
to UCC members?
Yes.
Because as a number of courts have held, they are approved.
Why,
by
though? What is the fundamental principle at stake?
The fundamental principle is you'll never get anybody to serve on one of these committees and absent they're being approved by the bankruptcy court. And
I never had the experience of practicing, of working as a bankruptcy judge.
I only did it for 4 months.
As Judge Kaczynski did.
It was good.
But my understanding was my limited understanding is that the Unsecured Creditors Committee is sort of like, it's identified by a statute. Its authority comes from there's a statute that authorizes an Unsecured Creditors Committee. Is that right?
It's authorized by a statute.
But it has certain duties.
But then it's approved by the bankruptcy court.
Where is it approved by the, is there some, who files a petition that says, bankruptcy court approved this makeup of this creditors committee? When does that happen?
The bankruptcy, you are correct that the UCC was set up by statute and they were appointed by the largest creditors. And then ultimately, once that was appointed, Judge Cursor, the bankruptcy court judge, approves the actions that they take.
But whose interests were they operating
yeah.
in?
Who's They essentially operated on behalf of the estate because they were attempting to recover money for the estate.
But their primary role, though, is to look out for the interest of all the unsecured creditors, correct?
Which they look out for
generally the interest. Generally speaking.
Generally speaking, but by looking out for the unsecured creditors, they also look out for the estate.
Well, let me ask you this. As my understanding here, though, is that at some point, I guess it was part of the plan, the unsecured creditors committee in this particular case took on a greater role.
They did. They went.
The judge charged them with the responsibility of determining whether litigation was appropriate.
That is correct.
Correct?
They did. They filed a motion. Judge Kercer approved that they could proceed with litigation against Mr. Blixeth. They did take on a larger role.
Is your argument that any creditors committee is subject to Barton, or because of that role they're subject to Barton?
Because of the role in this particular case, because of the actions that they took, which precipitated ultimately, as Mr. Dubek said, the judgment being entered against Mr. Blixeth. It was their role in precipitating that litigation.
And you know, you gave an answer to one of my questions, which sounded to me like you were saying that the district court approved the composition of the creditors committee. That's what I understood you to say. Is that right?
It approves their actions. It did not approve the composition. The composition.
Okay, so you misspoke when you said they approved the court.
If I did, then I misspoke.
You did say that, and your brief says that, and is that not so?
The bankruptcy court approves their actions.
But did they approve the people?
It approves the appointment by allowing them to proceed with particular actions. There is not a separate order entered by.
You're better off just saying no, because you're just digging yourself in deeper. You put something in your brief that really wasn't accurate. You said something to me this morning that really isn't accurate. He got caught.
No.
Okay, so the fact of the matter is there is no order of the bankruptcy court approving the composition of the committee.
And my brief
No, is that right?
There is no order of the court appointing the bankruptcy court, the UCC committee.
Appointing the committee or approving the membership? Saying these are the names and I approve them. There's nothing like that.
There is no order saying.
So to the extent you said something different, and to the extent your brief says something different, it's wrong.
And I respectfully disagree. My brief does not say that, Your Honor. My brief says that the bankruptcy court approved the actions of this UCC in precipitating litigation against Mr. Blixeth.
Well, we can run back the tape and see what you said this morning. You know, you are on video. You know.
But also, see, in this instance, it's the identity that's all important. I mean, the problem that he's pointing to is the fact that the person who was in the person of Mr. Brown, he's claiming had duties of loyalty to him and shouldn't have been on this committee. If the judge did not approve the appointment of Mr. Brown to the committee or appoint him, then where does the Barton concern come in? Even if he approved what they did.
Actually, Mr. Blixeth was in favor of Mr. Brown being on the committee. That came out in the end.
What does that have to do with my question?
Well, you had said that Mr. Blixeth was against it.
I didn't say that. I said that he's now complaining that there was a duty of loyalty. But the question is, I've been troubled all along by this case, by the fact, why would the judge put a lawyer who had in any way represented Mr. Blixeth in any of these proceedings in a position of authority? Now you're telling me that the judge didn't, in fact.
But as you read the excerpts of the record, Mr. Brown did not participate in decisions concerning Mr. Blixeth. Mr. Brown's duty of loyalty was addressed.
But that's not what I'm asking you. I'm saying that if the judge had, knowing this connection, had made the appointment, it would be one thing. But that's not what happened here.
The judge did not enter the order appointing Mr.
Or approving him or anything else.
There's not a separate order approving them. There's an order approving their actions.
Let me ask you a slightly different question. Assuming that, and we haven't even gotten a Stern, which is another big problem for you, let's say Mr. Brown had not been on the creditors committee at all. Would any of the allegations of the complaint state a claim against him?
Would they stay the same?
Would they state a claim?
No, sir, they would not.
Why not? They allege pre-petition conduct that damaged Mr. Blick says. Well, why?
Because there was a hearing on it. And
I mean, there was advice given with regard to the loan, and there was advice given with regard to the marital dissolution. Those are the allegations. So let's say he wasn't on the committee at all. Why wouldn't those state pre-petition claims that are independent of the bankruptcy?
Because they've already had a hearing on it, and the Judge Cursor determined that the advice they claim was given.
But that's not that's not the judgment in this case. The judgment in this case rests on Stern and Barton, right?
The judgment.
We can't enter summary judgment here. I mean, what you're saying is they lose on the merits. But I was asking a different question. Does he state a claim?
Does he state a claim? No, he does not state a claim. Just because you say somebody committed malpractice doesn't mean you've stated a claim. You have to have the facts to back up that claim. And in this case, he didn't have the facts. The advice was not given that they claim. They had a hearing on it. It was determined that he did not give the advice they claim was given. His role was different on the Credit Suisse loan, different on the marriage settlement agreement release. On the marriage settlement agreement,
but we're looking at a complaint, and this is what we're trying to get you to focus on.
Yes.
In this case, a complaint. He says that's not what happened in the complaint. All right. If the case goes forward, you can win, but that's not the question.
Right. And when you look at the complaint and you read it in total, all of the alleged acts are tied to what Mr. Brown supposedly did in bankruptcy court by reneging on it on the advice.
That's why I asked you the question. Let's say he was not on the committee.
If he was not on the committee,
there's no
bankruptcy proceeding at all involving Mr. Brown.
There is a bankruptcy proceeding, but Mr. Brown is not on the committee. Wouldn't he have suffered the same harm, everything that he alleges in the complaint? I mean, we just changed the one fact. He's not, Mr. Brown is not on the committee. Doesn't the complaint state a perfectly valid claim?
No, because the complaint says that all of Mr. Brown's acts are what caused the trustee to proceed against Mr. Blixeth and ultimately to get the Class B shareholders, the Lamond Group,
to
proceed against
Mr. Blixeth. But what we're trying to get you to tell us, and I asked the same question 15 minutes ago or 10 minutes ago, was if the complaint was that Mr. Brown did all these things pre-petition, which I understand you say he didn't do, but that's what it says, and this all ended up in bankruptcy, and because of that, there was a lawsuit filed for breach of fiduciary duty and fraudulent transfer, and it ended up with a huge judgment against Mr. Blixeth, all because of what Mr. Brown did, and let's assume Mr. Brown was not on the committee. Is there anything about that complaint? And it wasn't in the complaint that he was on the committee. Is there anything about that complaint that would preclude it from going forward without a Barton problem?
He's not a member. He's not a court-appointed officer. Then, no, I believe he'd be able to proceed.
All right. So the fact that the bankruptcy occurred and all this stuff occurred is not the problem. The problem is that there's some discussion of Mr. Brown being on the committee.
It's Mr. Brown's role on the committee because supposedly his role on the committee, he precipitated the trustee and others proceeding and ultimately obtaining judgments against Mr. Brown. Against Mr. Blixer.
What about your Stern problem? You want to deal with that?
Pardon?
What about your Stern problem?
The Stern problem, I believe, is the way they phrase it, is Judge Cursor didn't have the authority to enter a final order in this case. And it doesn't make any difference because, as ruled in executive benefits, even if Judge Cursor should have entered only findings of fact and conclusions of law because there was a de novo review done by the district court, Judge Haddon, that cures that error.
I think it was Judge Malloy.
No, I apologize. Judge Malloy was first, then Judge Cursor, Judge Haddon. Judge Haddon is the one who reviewed
We're reviewing Judge Malloy's.
No, you're reviewing.
No, Judge Haddon.
Judge Haddon's the one who affirmed the denial of the motion.
Judge Malloy originally told him to do findings and conclusions.
Okay.
That's correct.
But
Judge Malloy
didn't do it that way.
Judge Malloy told him to do findings and conclusions. But as I pointed out in the supplemental authority under Wellness International, if you consent, and this court's already ruled in N. Ray Bellingham that a party can consent by proceeding in bankruptcy court. And Mr. Blixeth.
Did the bankruptcy court here, in fact, have proposed findings and conclusions?
Did it prepare separate proposed findings? No, sir. It prepared what was a final order.
And did the district court say it was adopting a, it was entering its own order? I thought it said affirmed.
No, it said affirmed based upon its own separate de novo review. And under an executive benefits, even if the bankruptcy court erred in not making that order as findings and conclusions, under executive benefits, a de novo review cures that error.
Was the judgment here, was the bankruptcy court's order even a final judgment?
Was this the motion?
On the merits? Yes.
The denial of the motion for leave to sue?
Right. Is it a final judgment?
It's not a final judgment. It was a final order.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Your Honors, the DeLorean case involved counsel for a trustee. There was no UCC. It's in opposite to the situation we have here. Here, there isn't any quasi-judicial function served by Mr. Brown. Indeed, what's really curious to me, and again, I haven't been involved in the other bankruptcy processes here, but what's interesting to me is that you have an attorney who tells other folks wondering about his potential conflict situation that, quote, I know better than almost anyone, almost the various agreements which have been struck over the years.
Well, of course, he was also, I mean, it's all very complicated because he was also the lawyer for the debtor at various points and I think for BGI. So what hat he was wearing when he learned whatever he learned, we don't know.
But I think Your Honor's questions about let's assume that he wasn't on the committee is a perfect question to ask. And I sense from the response that's been given is that the malpractice case would have been able to proceed. Thus, we're in a situation where because of an interpretation and application of Barton, which I think is wrong, we're precluded from doing anything about the acts and omissions committed by Mr. Brown pre-petition, for that matter, post-petition. And I think that's wrong. Now,
does it make any difference here on Barton that the district, that the bankruptcy judge sort of approved and commissioned almost the unsecured creditors committee to look at, you know, going after assets?
I don't know that the bankruptcy judge commissioned.
Well, I mean, that's a little strong, but authorized them.
But, no, I don't think that, that changes. I think in a complicated bankruptcy case,
well, let me ask you, in a regular bankruptcy case, does an unsecured creditors committee have the authority to sort of pursue litigation on behalf of the estate?
I don't know the answer. The specific answer to that, I presume that they could seek leave to do that. But I don't think there's any statute or any bankruptcy rule that entitles them of their own accord to initiate litigation.
Well, does it make a difference that they're working on behalf of the estate?
I don't know that they're working on behalf of the estate. I heard that allegation, but I think they're working on behalf of the unsecured creditors.
Well, sometimes you help often you help the unsecured creditors by helping the estate. If you augment the estate, since the unsecured creditors are very close to the bottom of the, among the last to recover. I guess the debtor himself is the last,
right?
But right above the debtor are the unsecured creditors, and everybody else gets their money, his money first. The government gets first. The secured creditors get the estate expenses come first. So by helping to enhance the estate, the unsecured creditors are helping themselves, right?
I'm sure it's a matter of perspective, and that can certainly happen. But I think that their primary obligation and goal is to help themselves.
Do you know who actually appoints the creditors committee? I know they get elected.
I think they're appointed by the U.S. trustee office.
Is it the U.S. trustee? I now don't remember.
And the judge only, this is my understanding, I've had some weird bankruptcy experience, but it doesn't count for this
purpose. We won't pry into it.
And my understanding is that the judge would get involved only if he's got a problem with one of the folks on the committee and then would have some contact with the U.S. Trustee's office about doing something about that issue. But that's my understanding of the bankruptcy judge's role vis-a-vis appointing, not appointing folks to the UCC.
What about the argument raised by opposing counsel that whether or not Barton Bite's term applies, we really, the policy applies, and we really ought to extend it, if necessary, to apply to the Creditors Committee, because this is a statutory committee that helps the court function. It's a little bit like, not quite, but like the U.S. trustee, the prosecutor in a criminal case. You know, it's a part of the process without which the court couldn't perform
its function. Judge Moore, go ahead.
No, that's you know, I think there's some validity to that, but I don't think that that can somehow be utilized.
Well, the idea would be that they're out there doing these functions which are necessary for the court to complete this process, and if people can just sue them without permission of the court, they could get bogged down in this collateral litigation and wouldn't be able to interfere with the administration of the estate. There's something to that argument, don't you think?
I think there is. I would concede that there is, Judge. On the other hand, you know, I don't think Mr. Brown went in volunteering to be the head of the committee, believing that he had any immunity, because at that time, in the Ninth Circuit, there wasn't any such beast. There wasn't any immunity for folks serving.
Well, maybe not, but whatever we say will govern future creditors committees, and so we can't focus just on Mr. Brown. Why, as a matter of policy, shouldn't the Barton Doctrine be extended, if necessary, to include members of the credit committee?
Well, it certainly would be an incentive for folks to get on the committee to avoid potential liability.
Well, they'd only be they would only avoid liability for things they do as members of the committee. Wouldn't necessarily impact your complaint in this case. But why shouldn't there be the Barton Doctrine, the whole policy of it be that if you are performing functions as a member of a creditors committee or as a trustee, you are sort of key cog in the machinery of the administering the estate, and people shouldn't sue you for that conduct without permission of the judge. So it makes a great deal of sense, don't you think?
There is some sense to be made of
but
that.
Also, the Barton Doctrine as such doesn't preclude anybody from suing anybody. It just says where you sue, right?
Well, it provides immunity for folks that are specifically...
I thought it doesn't provide immunity. It provides immunity if you can assume in bankruptcy court. There are separate doctrines that provide immunity, but Barton itself has nothing to do with it. It's not an immunity doctrine. Is that right?
But it's not an immunity doctrine, but it does provide protection until the issue can be looked at.
Right. Okay.
And that hasn't happened in this case. There haven't been findings and conclusions. There hasn't been an evidentiary hearing on the amended complaint. You know, we filed the amended complaint,
but there was a determination made that that Barton applies, and B, that applying the applicable factors, you shouldn't be allowed to go forward with the suit. But the second part is not what we've been discussing at all. We've been discussing the first part, right? And yes. So it's not an immunity doctrine as such. Oh, I have one more question, and I know you're way over your time. But Judge Malloy said specifically the following. Mr. Brown, as chair of the Unsecured Creditors Committee, was a court-approved officer. In the past, bankruptcy courts were responsible for appointing members of an unsecured creditors committee, he says. But now the United States Treasury, the trustee, has responsibility for that task. Since the United States trustee's appointments are subject to the bankruptcy court's approval, committee members are functionally equivalent to court-appointed officers. Now, that seems completely contrary to what we were told earlier. So which is the case? Was Judge Malloy just flat wrong about all this?
No, I think Judge Malloy was trying to give credence, credibility to folks appointed to serve on committees such as this.
Were they formally appointed by the bankruptcy court, and does the bankruptcy court approve the appointments or not?
No, they weren't.
So he's wrong.
I think Judge Malloy is technically wrong on that point. I always hate to pick on classmates, but I don't think he was right on that. This committee and none of the people on the committee were specifically appointed by the bankruptcy court. They just weren't. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Okay, well, case is argued. We'll stand.